Chapter 17. Icarus. What goes up? Flying high. The launch of the Macintosh in January 1984 propelled Jobs into an even higher orbit of celebrity, as was evident during a trip to Manhattan he took at the time. He went to a party that Yoko Ono threw for her son, Sean Lennon, and gave the 9-year-old a Macintosh. The boy loved it. The artists Andy Warhol and Keith Haring were there, and they were so enthralled by what they could create with the machine that the contemporary art world almost took an ominous turn. "I drew a circle," Warhol exclaimed proudly after using QuickDraw. Warhol insisted that Jobs take a computer to Mick Jagger. When Jobs arrived at the rock star's townhouse, Jagger seemed baffled. He didn't quite know who Jobs was. Later, Jobs told his team, "I think he was on drugs. Either that or he's brain damaged." Jagger's daughter Jade, however, took to the computer immediately and started drawing with Mac Paint, so Jobs gave it to her instead. He bought the top-floor duplex apartment that he'd shown Scully in the San Remo on Manhattan's Central Park West and hired James Freed of I.M. Pei's firm to renovate it, but he never moved in. He would later sell it to Bono for $15 million. He also bought an old Spanish colonial-style 14-bedroom mansion in Woodside, in the hills above Palo Alto, that had been built by a copper baron, which he moved into but never got around to furnishing. At Apple, his status revived. Instead of seeking ways to curtail Jobs's authority, Scully gave him more. The Lisa and Macintosh divisions were folded together, with Jobs in charge. He was flying high, but this did not serve to make him more mellow. Indeed, there was a memorable display of his brutal honesty when he stood in front of the combined Lisa and Macintosh teams to describe how they would be merged. His Macintosh group leaders would get all of the top positions, he said, and a quarter of the Lisa staff would be laid off. "You guys failed," he said, looking directly at those who had worked on the Lisa. "You're a B team. B players. Too many people here are B or C players. So today, we are releasing some of you to have the opportunity to work at our sister companies here in the Valley." Bill Atkinson, who had worked on both teams, thought it was not only callous but unfair. "These people had worked really hard and were brilliant engineers," he said. But Jobs had latched on to what he believed was a key management lesson from his Macintosh experience. You have to be ruthless if you want to build a team of A players. It's too easy as a team grows to put up with a few B players, and they then attract a few more B players, and soon you will even have some C players, he recalled. "The Macintosh experience taught me that A players like to work only with other A players, which means you can't indulge B players." For the time being, Jobs and Scully were able to convince themselves that their friendship was still strong. They professed their fondness so effusively and often that they sounded like high school sweethearts at a Hallmark card display. The first anniversary of Scully's arrival came in May 1984, and to celebrate, Jobs lured him to a dinner party at Le Mouton Noir, an elegant restaurant in the hills southwest of Cupertino. To Scully's surprise, Jobs had gathered the Apple board, its top managers, and even some East Coast investors. As they all congratulated him during cocktails, Scully recalled, a beaming Steve stood in the background, nodding his head up and down and wearing a Cheshire Cat smile on his face. Jobs began the dinner with a fulsome toast. "The happiest 2 days for me were when Macintosh shipped and when John Scully agreed to join Apple," he said. "This has been the greatest year I've ever had in my whole life because I've learned so much from John." He then presented Scully with a montage of memorabilia from the year. In response, Scully effused about the joys of being Jobs' partner for the past year, and he concluded with a line that, for different reasons, everyone at the table found memorable. "Apple has one leader," he said, "Steve and me." He looked across the room, caught Jobs's eye, and watched him smile. "It was as if we were communicating with each other," Scully recalled. But he also noticed that Arthur Rock and some of the others were looking quizzical, perhaps even skeptical. They were worried that Jobs was completely rolling him. They had hired Scully to control Jobs, and now it was clear that Jobs was the one in control. Scully was so eager for Steve's approval that he was unable to stand up to him, Rock recalled. Keeping Jobs happy and deferring to his expertise may have seemed like a smart strategy to Scully, but he failed to realize that it was not in Jobs' nature to share control. Deference did not come naturally to him. He began to become more vocal about how he thought the company should be run. At the 1984 business strategy meeting, for example, he pushed to make the company's centralized sales and marketing staffs bid on the right to provide their services to the various product divisions. This would have meant, for example, that the Macintosh group could decide not to use Apple's marketing team and instead create one of its own. No one else was in favor, but Jobs kept trying to ram it through. "People were looking to me to take control, to get him to sit down and shut up, but I didn't," Scully recalled. As the meeting broke up, he heard someone whisper, "Why doesn't Scully shut him up?" When Jobs decided to build a state-of-the-art factory in Fremont to manufacture the Macintosh, his aesthetic passions and controlling nature kicked into high gear. He wanted the machinery to be painted in bright hues, like the Apple logo, but he spent so much time going over paint chips that Apple's manufacturing director, Matt Carter, finally just installed them in their usual beige and gray. When Jobs took a tour, he ordered that the machines be repainted in the bright colors he wanted. Carter objected. This was precision equipment, and repainting the machines could cause problems. He turned out to be right. One of the most expensive machines, which got painted bright blue, ended up not working properly and was dubbed Steve's Folly. Finally, Carter quit. It took so much energy to fight him, and it was usually over something so pointless that finally I had enough, he recalled. Jobs tapped as a replacement Debbie Coleman, the spunky but good-natured Macintosh financial officer who had once won the team's annual award for the person who best stood up to Jobs. But she knew how to cater to his whims when necessary. When Apple's art director, Clement Mock, informed her that Jobs wanted the walls to be pure white, she protested. "You can't paint a factory pure white. There's going to be dust and stuff all over," Mock replied. "There's no white that's too white for Steve." She ended up going along. With its pure white walls and its bright blue, yellow, and red machines, the factory floor looked like an Alexander Calder showcase, said Coleman. When asked about his obsessive concern over the look of the factory, Jobs said it was a way to ensure a passion for perfection. "I'd go out to the factory, and I'd put on a white glove to check for dust. I'd find it everywhere, on machines, on the tops of the racks, on the floor, and I'd ask Debbie to get it cleaned. I told her I thought we should be able to eat off the floor of the factory." Well, this drove Debbie up the wall. She didn't understand why, and I couldn't articulate it back then. See, I'd been very influenced by what I'd seen in Japan. Part of what I greatly admired there, and part of what we were lacking in our factory, was a sense of teamwork and discipline. If we didn't have the discipline to keep that place spotless, then we weren't going to have the discipline to keep all these machines running. One Sunday morning, Jobs brought his father to see the factory. Paul Jobs had always been fastidious about making sure that his craftsmanship was exacting and his tools in order, and his son was proud to show that he could do the same. Coleman came along to give the tour. Steve was like beaming, she recalled. He was so proud to show his father this creation. Jobs explained how everything worked, and his father seemed truly admiring. He kept looking at his father, who touched everything and loved how clean and perfect everything looked. Things were not quite as sweet when Danielle Mitterrand toured the factory. The Cuba-admiring wife of France's socialist president, François Mitterrand, asked a lot of questions through her translator about the working conditions, while Jobs, who had grabbed Alain Rossman to serve as his translator, kept trying to explain the advanced robotics and technology. After Jobs talked about the just-in-time production schedules, she asked about overtime pay. He was annoyed, so he described how automation helped him keep down labor costs, a subject he knew would not delight her. "Is it hard work?" she asked. "How much vacation time do they get?" Jobs couldn't contain himself. "If she's so interested in their welfare," he said to her translator, "tell her she can come work here anytime." The translator turned pale and said nothing. After a moment, Rossman stepped in to say, in French, "Monsieur Jobs says he thanks you for your visit and your interest in the factory." Neither Jobs nor Madame Mitterrand knew what happened, Rossman recalled, but her translator looked very relieved. Afterward, as he sped his Mercedes down the freeway toward Cupertino, Jobs fumed to Rossman about Madame Mitterrand's attitude. At one point, he was going just over 100 miles per hour when a policeman stopped him and began writing a ticket. After a few minutes, as the officer scribbled away, Jobs honked. "Excuse me," the policeman said. Jobs replied, "I'm in a hurry." Amazingly, the officer didn't get mad. He simply finished writing the ticket and warned that if Jobs was caught going over 55 again, he would be sent to jail. As soon as the policeman left, Jobs got back on the road and accelerated to 100. He absolutely believed that the normal rules didn't apply to him, Rossman marveled. His wife Joanna Hoffman saw the same thing when she accompanied Jobs to Europe a few months after the Macintosh was launched. "He was just completely obnoxious and thinking he could get away with anything," she recalled. In Paris, she had arranged a formal dinner with French software developers, but Jobs suddenly decided he didn't want to go. Instead, he shut the car door on Hoffman and told her he was going to see the poster artist Fallon instead. "The developers were so pissed off they wouldn't shake our hands," she said. In Italy, he took an instant dislike to Apple's general manager, a soft, rotund guy who had come from a conventional business. Jobs told him bluntly that he was not impressed with his team or his sales strategy. "You don't deserve to be able to sell the Mac," Jobs said coldly. But that was mild compared to his reaction to the restaurant the hapless manager had chosen. Jobs demanded a vegan meal, but the waiter very elaborately proceeded to dish out a sauce filled with sour cream. Jobs got so nasty that Hoffman had to threaten him. She whispered that if he didn't calm down, she was going to pour her hot coffee on his lap. The most substantive disagreements Jobs had on the European trip concerned sales forecasts. Using his reality distortion field, Jobs was always pushing his team to come up with higher projections. He kept threatening the European managers that he wouldn't give them any allocations unless they projected bigger forecasts. They insisted on being realistic, and Hoffman had to referee. "By the end of the trip, my whole body was shaking uncontrollably," Hoffman recalled. It was on this trip that Jobs first got to know Jean-Louis Gasset, Apple's manager in France. Gasset was among the few to stand up successfully to Jobs on the trip. "He has his own way with the truth," Gasset later remarked. The only way to deal with him was to outbully him. When Jobs made his usual threat about cutting down on France's allocations if Gasset didn't jack up sales projections, Gasset got angry. "I remember grabbing his lapel and telling him to stop, and then he backed down. I used to be an angry man myself. I am a recovering assaholic. so I could recognize that in Steve. Gasse was impressed, however, at how Jobs could turn on the charm when he wanted to. François Mitterrand had been preaching the gospel of informatique pour tous, computing for all, and various academic experts in technology such as Marvin Minsky and Nicholas Negroponte came over to sing in the choir. Jobs gave a talk to the group at the Hotel Bristol and painted a picture of how France could move ahead if it put computers in all of its schools. Paris also brought out the romantic in him. Both Gasse and Negroponte tell tales of him pining over women while there. Falling. After the burst of excitement that accompanied the release of Macintosh, its sales began to taper off in the second half of 1984. The problem was a fundamental one. It was a dazzling but woefully slow and underpowered computer, and no amount of hoopla could mask that. Its beauty was that its user interface looked like a sunny playroom rather than a somber dark screen with sickly green pulsating letters and surly command lines. But that led to its greatest weakness. A character on a text-based display took less than a byte of code, whereas when the Mac drew a letter, pixel by pixel, in any elegant font you wanted, it required 20 or 30 times more memory. The Lisa handled this by shipping with more than 1,000K RAM, whereas the Macintosh may do with 128K. Another problem was the lack of an internal hard disk drive. Jobs had called Joanna Hoffman a Xerox bigot when she fought for such a storage device. He insisted that the Macintosh have just one floppy disk drive. If you wanted to copy data, you could end up with a new form of tennis elbow from having to swap floppy disks in and out of the single drive. In addition, the Macintosh lacked a fan, another example of Jobs's dogmatic stubbornness. Fans, he felt, detracted from the calm of a computer. This caused many component failures and earned the Macintosh the nickname the Beige Toaster, which did not enhance its popularity. It was so seductive that it had sold well enough for the first few months, but when people became more aware of its limitations, sales fell. As Hoffman later lamented, the reality distortion field can serve as a spur, but then reality itself hits. At the end of 1984, with Lisa sales virtually non-existent and Macintosh sales falling below 10,000 a month, Jobs made a shoddy and atypical decision out of desperation. He decided to take the inventory of unsold Lisas, graft on a Macintosh emulation program, and sell them as a new product, the Macintosh XL. Since the Lisa had been discontinued and would not be restarted, it was an unusual instance of Jobs producing something that he did not believe in. "I was furious because the Mac XL wasn't real," said Hoffman. "It was just to blow the excess Lisas out the door. It sold well, and then we had to discontinue the horrible hoax, so I resigned." The dark mood was evident in the ad that was developed in January 1985, which was supposed to reprise the anti-IBM sentiment of the resonant 1984 ad. Unfortunately, there was a fundamental difference. The first ad had ended on a heroic, optimistic note, but the storyboards presented by Lee Clow and Jay Shiat for the new ad, titled Lemmings, showed dark-suited, blindfolded corporate managers marching off a cliff to their death. From the beginning, both Jobs and Scully were uneasy. It didn't seem as if it would convey a positive or glorious image of Apple, but instead would merely insult every manager who had bought an IBM. Jobs and Scully asked for other ideas, but the agency folks pushed back. "You guys didn't want to run 1984 last year," one of them said. According to Scully, Lee Clow added, "I will put my whole reputation, everything, on this commercial." When the filmed version, done by Ridley Scott's brother Tony, came in, the concept looked even worse. The mindless managers marching off the cliff were singing a funeral-paced version of the Snow White song, Hi Ho, Hi Ho, and the dreary filmmaking made it even more depressing than the storyboards portended. I can't believe you're going to insult business people across America by running that, Debbie Coleman yelled at Jobs when she saw the ad. At the marketing meetings, she stood up to make her point about how much she hated it. I literally put a resignation letter on his desk. I wrote it on my Mac. I thought it was an affront to corporate managers. We were just beginning to get a toehold with desktop publishing. Nevertheless, Jobs and Scully bent to the agencies and treaties and ran the commercial during the Super Bowl. They went to the game together at Stanford Stadium with Scully's wife, Lizzie, who couldn't stand Jobs, and Jobs' new girlfriend, Tina Redzi. When the commercial was shown near the end of the fourth quarter of a dreary game, the fans watched on the overhead screen and had little reaction. Across the country, most of the response was negative. It insulted the very people Apple was trying to reach, the president of a market research firm told Fortune. Apple's marketing manager suggested afterward that the company might want to buy an ad in the Wall Street Journal apologizing. Jay Chiat threatened that if Apple did that, his agency would buy the facing page and apologize for the apology. Jobs' discomfort with both the ad and the situation at Apple in general was on display when he traveled to New York in January to do another round of one-on-one press interviews. Andy Cunningham from Regis McKenna's firm was in charge of handholding and logistics at the Carlyle. When Jobs arrived, he told her that his suite needed to be completely redone, even though it was 10 p.m. and the meetings were to begin the next day. The piano was not in the right place. The strawberries were the wrong type. But his biggest objection was that he didn't like the flowers. He wanted calla lilies. We got into a big fight on what a calla lily is, Cunningham recalled. I know what they are, because I had them at my wedding, but he insisted on having a different type of lily and said I was stupid because I didn't know what a real calla lily was. So Cunningham went out, and this being New York, was able to find a place open at midnight where she could get the lilies he wanted. By the time they got the room rearranged, Jobs started objecting to what she was wearing. That suit's disgusting, he told her. Cunningham knew that at times he just simmered with undirected anger, so she tried to calm him down. Look, I know you're angry, and I know how you feel, she said. You have no fucking idea how I feel, he shot back. No fucking idea what it's like to be me. 30 years old. Turning 30 is a milestone for most people, especially those of the generation that proclaimed it would never trust anyone over that age. To celebrate his own 30th in February 1985, Jobs threw a lavishly formal but also playful black tie and tennis shoes party for 1,000 in the ballroom of the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. The invitation read, "There's an old Hindu saying that goes, in the first 30 years of your life, you make your habits. For the last 30 years of your life, your habits make you. Come help me celebrate mine." One table featured software moguls, including Bill Gates and Mitch Kapoor. Another had old friends, such as Elizabeth Holmes, who brought as her date a woman dressed in a tuxedo. Andy Hertzfeld and Burl Smith had rented tuxes and wore floppy tennis shoes, which made it all the more memorable when they danced to the Strauss waltzes played by the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. Ella Fitzgerald provided the entertainment, as Bob Dylan had declined. She sang mainly from her standard repertoire, though occasionally tailoring a song like The Girl from Ipanema to be about the boy from Cupertino. When she asked for some requests, Jobs called out a few. She concluded with a slow rendition of Happy Birthday. Scully came to the stage to propose a toast to technology's foremost visionary. Wozniak also came up and presented Jobs with a framed copy of the Zoltair hoax from the 1977 West Coast Computer Fair, where the Apple II had been introduced. The venture capitalist Don Valentine marveled at the change in the decade since that time. He went from being a Ho Chi Minh lookalike who never said trust anyone over 30 to a person who gives himself a fabulous 30th birthday with Ella Fitzgerald, he said. Many people had picked out special gifts for a person who was not easy to shop for. Debbie Coleman, for example, found a first edition of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Last Tycoon. But Jobs, in an act that was odd yet not out of character, left all of the gifts in a hotel room. Wozniak and some of the Apple veterans, who did not take to the goat cheese and salmon mousse that was served, met after the party and went out to eat at a Denny's. It's rare that you see an artist in his 30s or 40s able to really contribute something amazing, Jobs said wistfully to the writer David Sheff, who published a long and intimate interview in Playboy the month he turned 30. Of course, there are some people who are innately curious, forever little kids in their awe of life, but they're rare. The interview touched on many subjects, but Jobs's most poignant ruminations were about growing old and facing the future. Your thoughts construct patterns like scaffolding in your mind. You are really etching chemical patterns. In most cases, people get stuck in those patterns, just like grooves in a record, and they never get out of them. I'll always stay connected with Apple. I hope that throughout my life I'll sort of have the thread of my life and the thread of Apple weave in and out of each other like a tapestry. There may be a few years when I'm not there, but I'll always come back. If you want to live your life in a creative way, as an artist, you have to not look back too much. You have to be willing to take whatever you've done and whoever you were and throw them away. The more the outside world tries to reinforce an image of you, the harder it is to continue to be an artist, which is why a lot of times artists have to say, bye, I have to go, I'm going crazy and I'm getting out of here. And they go and hibernate somewhere. Maybe later they reemerge a little differently. With each of those statements, Jobs seemed to have a premonition that his life would soon be changing. Perhaps the thread of his life would indeed weave in and out of the thread of Apple's. Perhaps it was time to throw away some of what he had been. Perhaps it was time to say, bye, I have to go, and then reemerge later, thinking differently. Exodus. Andy Hertzfeld had taken a leave of absence after the Macintosh came out in 1984. He needed to recharge his batteries and get away from his supervisor, Bob Belleville, whom he didn't like. One day he learned that Jobs had given out bonuses of up to $50,000 to engineers on the Macintosh team. So he went to Jobs to ask for one. Jobs responded that Belleville had decided not to give the bonuses to people who were on leave. Hertzfeld later heard that the decision had actually been made by Jobs, so he confronted him. At first, Jobs equivocated. Then he said, well, let's assume what you are saying is true. How does that change things? Hertzfeld said that if Jobs was withholding the bonus as a reason for him to come back, then he wouldn't come back as a matter of principle. Jobs relented, but it left Hertzfeld with a bad taste. When his leave was coming to an end, Hertzfeld made an appointment to have dinner with Jobs, and they walked from his office to an Italian restaurant a few blocks away. I really want to return, he told Jobs, but things seem really messed up right now. Jobs was vaguely annoyed and distracted, but Hertzfeld plunged ahead. The software team is completely demoralized and has hardly done a thing for months, and Burl is so frustrated that he won't last till the end of the year. At that point, Jobs cut him off. You don't know what you're talking about, he said. The Macintosh team is doing great, and I'm having the best time of my life right now. You're just completely out of touch. His stare was withering, but he also tried to look amused at Hertzfeld's assessment. "If you really believe that, I don't think there's any way that I can come back," Hertzfeld replied glumly. "The MAC team that I want to come back to doesn't even exist anymore." "The MAC team had to grow up, and so do you," Jobs replied. "I want you to come back, but if you don't want to, that's up to you. You don't matter as much as you think you do, anyway." Hertzfeld didn't come back. By early 1985, Burl Smith was also ready to leave. He had worried that it would be hard to quit if Jobs tried to talk him out of it. The reality distortion field was usually too strong for him to resist. So he plotted with Hertzfeld how he could break free of it. "I've got it," he told Hertzfeld one day. "I know the perfect way to quit that will nullify the reality distortion field. I'll just walk into Steve's office, pull down my pants, and urinate on his desk. What could he say to that? It's guaranteed to work." The betting on the MAC team was that even brave Burl Smith would not have the gumption to do that. When he finally decided he had to make his break around the times of Jobs' birthday bash, he made an appointment to see Jobs. He was surprised to find Jobs smiling broadly when he walked in. "Are you going to do it? Are you really going to do it?" Jobs asked. He had heard about the plan. Smith looked at him. "Do I have to? I'll do it if I have to." Jobs gave him a look, and Smith decided it wasn't necessary. So he resigned less dramatically and walked out on good terms. He was quickly followed by another of the great Macintosh engineers, Bruce Horn. When Horn went in to say goodbye, Jobs told him, "Everything that's wrong with the Mac is your fault." Horn responded, "Well, actually, Steve, a lot of the things that are right with the Mac are my fault, and I had to fight like crazy to get those things in." "You're right," admitted Jobs. "I'll give you 15,000 shares to stay." When Horn declined the offer, Jobs showed his warmer side. "Well, give me a hug," he said, and so they hugged. But the biggest news that month was the departure from Apple, yet again, of its co-founder, Steve Wozniak. Wozniak was then quietly working as a mid-level engineer in the Apple II division, serving as a humble mascot of the roots of the company and staying as far away from management and corporate politics as he could. He felt with justification that Jobs was not appreciative of the Apple II, which remained the cash cow of the company and accounted for 70% of its sales at Christmas 1984. People in the Apple II group were being treated as very unimportant by the rest of the company, he later said. This was despite the fact that the Apple II was by far the largest selling product in our company for ages and would be for years to come. He even roused himself to do something out of character. He picked up the phone one day and called Scully, berating him for lavishing so much attention on Jobs and the Macintosh division. Frustrated, Wozniak decided to leave quietly to start a new company that would make a universal remote control device he had invented. It would control your television, stereo, and other electronic devices with a simple set of buttons that you could easily program. He informed the head of engineering at the Apple II division, but he didn't feel he was important enough to go out of channels and tell Jobs or Markkula. So Jobs first heard about it when the news leaked in the Wall Street Journal. In his earnest way, Wozniak had openly answered the reporter's questions when he called. Yes, he said, he felt that Apple had been giving short shrift to the Apple II division. "Apple's direction has been horrendously wrong for 5 years," he said. Less than 2 weeks later, Wozniak and Jobs traveled together to the White House, where Ronald Reagan presented them with the first National Medal of Technology. The president quoted what President Rutherford Hayes had said when first shown a telephone: "An amazing invention, but who would ever want to use one?" And then quipped, "I thought at the time that he might be mistaken." Because of the awkward situation surrounding Wozniak's departure, Apple did not throw a celebratory dinner afterward. So Jobs and Wozniak went for a walk afterward and ate at a sandwich shop. They chatted amiably, Wozniak recalled, and avoided any discussion of their disagreements. Wozniak wanted to make the parting amicable. It was his style. So he agreed to stay on as a part-time Apple employee at a $20,000 salary and represent the company at events and trade shows. That could have been a graceful way to drift apart, but Jobs could not leave well enough alone. One Saturday, a few weeks after they had visited Washington together, Jobs went to the new Palo Alto studios of Hartmut Esslinger, whose company Frog Design had moved there to handle its design work for Apple. There he happened to see sketches that the firm had made for Wozniak's new remote control device, and he flew into a rage. Apple had a clause in its contract that gave it the right to bar Frog Design from working on other computer-related projects, and Jobs invoked it. "I informed them," he recalled, "that working with Woz wouldn't be acceptable to us." When the Wall Street Journal heard what happened, it got in touch with Wozniak, who, as usual, was open and honest. He said that Jobs was punishing him. "Steve Jobs has a hate for me, probably because of the things I said about Apple," he told the reporter. Jobs's action was remarkably petty, but it was also partly caused by the fact that he understood, in ways that others did not, that the look and style of a product served to brand it. A device that had Wozniak's name on it and used the same design language as Apple's products might be mistaken for something that Apple had produced. "It's not personal," Jobs told the newspaper, explaining that he wanted to make sure that Wozniak's remote wouldn't look like something made by Apple. "We don't want to see our design language used on other products. Woz has to find his own resources. He can't leverage off Apple's resources. We can't treat him specially." Jobs volunteered to pay for the work that Frog Design had already done for Wozniak, but even so, the executives at the firm were taken aback. When Jobs demanded that they send him the drawings done for Wozniak or destroy them, they refused. Jobs had to send them a letter invoking Apple's contractual right. Herbert Pfeiffer, the design director of the firm, risked Jobs' wrath by publicly dismissing his claim that the dispute with Wozniak was not personal. "It's a power play," Pfeiffer told the journal. "They have personal problems between them." Hertzfeld was outraged when he heard what Jobs had done. He lived about 12 blocks from Jobs, who sometimes would drop by on his walks. "I got so furious about the Wozniak remote episode that when Steve next came over, I wouldn't let him in the house," Hertzfeld recalled. He knew he was wrong, but he tried to rationalize, and maybe in his distorted reality he was able to. Wozniak, always a teddy bear even when annoyed, hired another design firm and even agreed to stay on Apple's retainer as a spokesman. Showdown, Spring 1985. There were many reasons for the rift between Jobs and Scully in the spring of 1985. Some were merely business disagreements, such as Scully's attempt to maximize profits by keeping the Macintosh price high when Jobs wanted to make it more affordable. Others were weirdly psychological and stem from the torrid and unlikely infatuation they initially had with each other. Scully had painfully craved Jobs's affection. Jobs had eagerly sought a father figure and mentor, and when the ardor began to cool, there was an emotional backwash. But at its core, the growing breach had two fundamental causes, one on each side. For Jobs, the problem was that Scully never became a product person. He didn't make the effort or show the capacity to understand the fine points of what they were making. On the contrary, he found Jobs' passion for tiny technical tweaks and design details to be obsessive and counterproductive. He had spent his career selling sodas and snacks whose recipes were largely irrelevant to him. He wasn't naturally passionate about products, which was among the most damning sins that Jobs could imagine. "I tried to educate him about the details of engineering," Jobs recalled, "but he had no idea how products are created, and after a while it just turned into arguments. But I learned that my perspective was right. Products are everything." He came to see Scully as clueless, and his contempt was exacerbated by Scully's hunger for his affection and delusions that they were very similar. For Scully, the problem was that Jobs, when he was no longer in courtship or manipulative mode, was frequently obnoxious, rude, selfish, and nasty to other people. He found Jobs's boorish behavior as despicable as Jobs found Scully's lack of passion for product details. Scully was kind, caring, and polite to a fault. At one point, they were planning to meet with Xerox's vice chair, Bill Glavin, and Scully begged Jobs to behave. But as soon as they sat down, Jobs told Glavin, "You guys don't have any clue what you're doing," and the meeting broke up. "I'm sorry, but I couldn't help myself," Jobs told Scully. It was one of many such cases. As Atari's Al Alcorn later observed, Scully believed in keeping people happy and worrying about relationships. Steve didn't give a shit about that, but he did care about the product in a way that Scully never could, and he was able to avoid having too many bozos working at Apple by insulting anyone who wasn't an A player. The board became increasingly alarmed at the turmoil, and in early 1985, Arthur Rock and some other disgruntled directors delivered a stern lecture to both. They told Scully that he was supposed to be running the company, and he should start doing so with more authority and less eagerness to be pals with Jobs. They told Jobs that he was supposed to be fixing the mess at the Macintosh division and not telling other divisions how to do their job. Afterward, Jobs retreated to his office and typed on his Macintosh, "I will not criticize the rest of the organization. I will not criticize the rest of the organization." As the Macintosh continued to disappoint, sales in March 1985 were only 10% of the budget forecast, Jobs holed up in his office fuming or wandered the halls berating everyone else for the problems. His mood swings became worse, and so did his abuse of those around him. Middle-level managers began to rise up against him. The marketing chief, Mike Murray, sought a private meeting with Scully at an industry conference. As they were going up to Scully's hotel room, Jobs spotted them and asked to come along. Murray asked him not to. He told Scully that Jobs was wreaking havoc and had to be removed from managing the Macintosh division. Scully replied that he was not yet resigned to having a showdown with Jobs. Murray later sent a memo directly to Jobs criticizing the way he treated colleagues and denouncing management by character assassination. For a few weeks, it seemed as if there might be a solution to the turmoil. Jobs became fascinated by a flat-screen technology developed by a firm near Palo Alto called Woodside Design, run by an eccentric engineer named Steve Kitchen. He also was impressed by another startup that made a touchscreen display that could be controlled by your finger, so you didn't need a mouse. Together, these might help fulfill Jobs's vision of creating a Mac in a book. On a walk with Kitchen, Jobs spotted a building in nearby Menlo Park and declared that they should open a Skunk Works factory to work on these ideas. It could be called Apple Labs, and Jobs could run it, going back to the joy of having a small team and developing a great new product. Scully was thrilled by the possibility. It would solve most of his management issues, moving Jobs back to what he did best and getting rid of his disruptive presence in Cupertino. Scully also had a candidate to replace Jobs as manager of the Macintosh division, Jean-Louis Gasset, Apple's chief in France, who had suffered through Jobs's visit there. Gasset flew to Cupertino and said he would take the job if he got a guarantee that he would run the division rather than work under Jobs. One of the board members, Phil Schlein of Macy's, tried to convince Jobs that he would be better off thinking up new products and inspiring a passionate little team. But after some reflection, Jobs decided that was not the path he wanted. He declined to cede control to Gasset, who wisely went back to Paris to avoid the power clash that was becoming inevitable. For the rest of the spring, Jobs vacillated. There were times when he wanted to assert himself as a corporate manager, even writing a memo urging cost savings by eliminating free beverages and first-class air travel, and other times when he agreed with those who were encouraging him to go off and run a new Apple Labs R&D group. In March, Murray let loose with another memo that he marked "Do Not Circulate," but gave to multiple colleagues. "In my 3 years at Apple, I've never observed so much confusion, fear, and dysfunction as in the past 90 days," he began. "We are perceived by the rank and file as a boat without a rudder, drifting away into foggy oblivion." Murray had been on both sides of the fence. At times he conspired with Jobs to undermine Scully, but in this memo he laid the blame on Jobs. Whether the cause of or because of the dysfunction, Steve Jobs now controls a seemingly impenetrable power base. At the end of that month, Scully finally worked up the nerve to tell Jobs that he should give up running the Macintosh division. He walked over to Jobs' office one evening and brought the human resources manager, Jay Elliott, to make the confrontation more formal. "There is no one who admires your brilliance and vision more than I do," Scully began. He had uttered such flatteries before, but this time it was clear that there would be a brutal "but" punctuating the thought. And there was. "But this is really not going to work," he declared. The flatteries, punctured by buts, continued. "We have developed a great friendship with each other," he said, "but I have lost confidence in your ability to run the Macintosh division." He also berated Jobs for bad-mouthing him as a bozo behind his back. Jobs looked stunned and countered with an odd challenge, that Scully should help and coach him more. "You've got to spend more time with me." Then he lashed back. He told Scully he knew nothing about computers, was doing a terrible job running the company, and had disappointed Jobs ever since coming to Apple. Then he began to cry. Scully sat there biting his fingernails. "I'm going to bring this up with the board," Scully declared. "I'm going to recommend that you step down from your operating position of running the Macintosh division. I want you to know that." He urged Jobs not to resist and to agree instead to work on developing new technologies and products. Jobs jumped from his seat and turned his intense stare on Scully. "I don't believe you're going to do that," he said. "If you do that, you're going to destroy the company." Over the next few weeks, Jobs' behavior fluctuated wildly. At one moment, he would be talking about going off to run Apple Labs, but in the next moment, he would be enlisting support to have Scully ousted. He would reach out to Scully, then lash out at him behind his back, sometimes on the same night. One night at 9, he called Apple's general counsel, Al Eisenstadt, to say he was losing confidence in Scully and needed his help convincing the board to fire him. At 11 the same night, he phoned Scully to say, "You're terrific, and I just want you to know I love working with you." At the board meeting on April 11th, Scully officially reported that he wanted to ask Jobs to step down as the head of the Macintosh division and focus instead on new product development. Arthur Rock, the most crusty and independent of the board members, then spoke. He was fed up with both of them, with Scully for not having the guts to take command over the past year, and with Jobs for acting like a petulant brat. The board needed to get this dispute behind them, and to do so, it should meet privately with each of them. Scully left the room so that Jobs could present first. Jobs insisted that Scully was the problem because he had no understanding of computers. Rock responded by berating Jobs. In his growling voice, he said that Jobs had been behaving foolishly for a year and had no right to be managing a division. Even Jobs' strongest supporter, Phil Schlein, tried to talk him into stepping aside gracefully to run a research lab for the company. When it was Scully's turn to meet privately with the board, he gave an ultimatum. "You can back me, and then I take responsibility for running the company, or we can do nothing, and you're going to have to find yourselves a new CEO." If given the authority, he said, he would not move abruptly, but would ease Jobs into the new role over the next few months. The board unanimously sided with Scully. He was given the authority to remove Jobs whenever he felt the timing was right. As Jobs waited outside the boardroom, knowing full well that he was losing, he saw Del Yoakum, a longtime colleague, and hugged him. After the board made its decision, Scully tried to be conciliatory. Jobs asked that the transition occur slowly over the next few months, and Scully agreed. Later that evening, Scully's executive assistant, Nanette Buckhout, called Jobs to see how he was doing. He was still in his office, shell-shocked. Scully had already left, and Jobs came over to talk to her. Once again, he began oscillating wildly in his attitude toward Scully. "Why did John do this to me?" he said. "He betrayed me." Then he swung the other way. Perhaps he should take some time away to work on restoring his relationship with Scully, he said. "John's friendship is more important than anything else, and I think maybe that's what I should do. Concentrate on our friendship." Plotting a coup. Jobs was not good at taking no for an answer. He went to Scully's office in early May 1985 and asked for more time to show that he could manage the Macintosh division. He would prove himself as an operations guy, he promised. Scully didn't back down. Jobs next tried a direct challenge. He asked Scully to resign. "I think you really lost your stride," Jobs told him. "You were really great the first year and everything went wonderful, but something happened." Scully, who generally was even-tempered, lashed back, pointing out that Jobs had been unable to get the Macintosh software developed, come up with new models, or win customers. The meeting degenerated into a shouting match about who was the worst manager. After Jobs stalked out, Scully turned away from the glass wall of his office, where others had been looking in on the meeting, and wept. Matters began to come to a head on Tuesday, May 14th, when the Macintosh team made its quarterly review presentation to Scully and other Apple corporate leaders. Jobs still had not relinquished control of the division, and he was defiant when he arrived in the corporate boardroom with his team. He and Scully began by clashing over what the division's mission was. Jobs said it was to sell more Macintosh machines. Scully said it was to serve the interests of the Apple company as a whole. As usual, there was little cooperation among the divisions. For one thing, the Macintosh team was planning new disk drives that were different from those being developed by the Apple II division. The debate, according to the minutes, took a full hour. Jobs then described the projects underway: a more powerful Mac, which would take the place of the discontinued Lisa, and software called File Server, which would allow Macintosh users to share files on a network. Scully learned for the first time that these projects were going to be late. He gave a cold critique of Murray's marketing record, Belleville's missed engineering deadlines, and Jobs's overall management. Despite all this, Jobs ended the meeting with a plea to Scully, in front of all the others there, to be given one more chance to prove he could run a division. Scully refused. That night, Jobs took his Macintosh team out to dinner at Nina's Cafe in Woodside. Jean-Louis Gasset was in town because Scully wanted him to prepare to take over the Macintosh division, and Jobs invited him to join them. Belleville proposed a toast: "To those of us who really understand what the world according to Steve Jobs is all about." That phrase, The world, according to Steve, had been used dismissively by others at Apple who belittled the reality warp he created. After the others left, Belleville sat with Jobs in his Mercedes and urged him to organize a battle to the death with Scully. Months earlier, Apple had gotten the right to export computers to China, and Jobs had been invited to sign a deal in the Great Hall of the People over the 1985 Memorial Day weekend. He had told Scully, who decided he wanted to go himself, which was just fine with Jobs. Jobs decided to use Scully's absence to execute his coup. Throughout the week leading up to Memorial Day, he took a lot of people on walks to share his plans. "I'm going to launch a coup while John is in China," he told Mike Murray. 7 days in May. Thursday, May 23rd. At his regular Thursday meeting with his top lieutenants in the Macintosh division, Jobs told his inner circle about his plan to oust Scully. He also confided in the corporate human resources director, Jay Elliott, who told him bluntly that the proposed rebellion wouldn't work. Elliott had talked to some board members and urged them to stand up for Jobs, but he discovered that most of the board was with Scully, as were most members of Apple's senior staff. Yet Jobs barreled ahead. He even revealed his plans to Jean-Louis Gasset on a walk around the parking lot, despite the fact that Gasset had come from Paris to take his job. "I made the mistake of telling Gasset," Jobs wryly conceded years later. That evening, Apple's general counsel, Al Eisenstadt, had a small barbecue at his home for Scully, Gasset, and their wives. When Gasset told Eisenstadt what Jobs was plotting, he recommended that Gasset inform Scully. "Steve was trying to raise a cabal and have a coup to get rid of John," Gasset recalled. In the den of Al Eisenstadt's house, "I put my index finger lightly on John's breastbone and said, 'If you leave tomorrow for China, you could be ousted. Steve's plotting to get rid of you.'" Friday, May 24th. Scully canceled his trip and decided to confront Jobs at the executive staff meeting on Friday morning. Jobs arrived late, and he saw that his usual seat next to Scully, who sat at the head of the table, was taken. He sat instead at the far end. He was dressed in a well-tailored suit and looked energized. Scully looked pale. He announced that he was dispensing with the agenda to confront the issue on everyone's mind. "It's come to my attention that you'd like to throw me out of the company," he said, looking directly at Jobs. "I'd like to ask you if that's true." Jobs was not expecting this, but he was never shy about indulging in brutal honesty. His eyes narrowed, and he fixed Scully with his unblinking stare. "I think you're bad for Apple, and I think you're the wrong person to run the company," he replied, coldly and slowly. "You really should leave this company. You don't know how to operate, and never have." He accused Scully of not understanding the product development process, and then he added a self-centered swipe. "I wanted you here to help me grow, and you've been ineffective in helping me." As the rest of the room sat frozen, Scully finally lost his temper. A childhood stutter that had not afflicted him for 20 years started to return. "I don't trust you, and I won't tolerate a lack of trust," he stammered. When Jobs claimed that he would be better than Scully at running the company, Scully took a gamble. He decided to poll the room on that question. "He pulled off this clever maneuver," Jobs recalled, still smarting 35 years later. "It was at the executive committee meeting, and he said, 'It's me or Steve. Who do you vote for?' He set the whole thing up so that you'd kinda have to be an idiot to vote for me." Suddenly, the frozen onlookers began to squirm. Del Yoakum had to go first. He said he loved Jobs, wanted him to continue to play some role in the company, but he worked up the nerve to conclude, with Jobs staring at him, that he respected Scully and would support him to run the company. Eisenstadt faced Jobs directly and said much the same thing. He liked Jobs but was supporting Scully. Regis McKenna, who sat in on senior staff meetings as an outside consultant, was more direct. He looked at Jobs and told him he was not yet ready to run the company, something he had told him before. Others sided with Scully as well. For Bill Campbell, it was particularly tough. He was fond of Jobs and didn't particularly like Scully. His voice quavered a bit as he told Jobs he had decided to support Scully, and he urged the two of them to work it out and find some role for Jobs to play in the company. "You can't let Steve leave this company," he told Scully. Jobs looked shattered. "I guess I know where things stand," he said, and bolted out of the room. No one followed. He went back to his office, gathered his longtime loyalists on the McIntosh staff, and started to cry. He would have to leave Apple, he said. As he started to walk out the door, Debbie Coleman restrained him. She and the others urged him to settle down and not do anything hasty. He should take the weekend to regroup. Perhaps there was a way to prevent the company from being torn apart. Scully was devastated by his victory. Like a wounded warrior, he retreated to Eisenstadt's office and asked the corporate counsel to go for a ride. When they got into Eisenstadt's Porsche, Scully lamented, "I don't know whether I can go through with this." When Eisenstadt asked what he meant, Scully responded, "I think I'm going to resign." "You can't," Eisenstadt protested. "Apple will fall apart." "I'm going to resign," Scully declared. "I don't think I'm right for the company."
"I think you're copping out," Eisenstadt replied. "You've got to stand up to him."
Then he drove Scully home. Scully's wife was surprised to see him back in the middle of the day. "I've failed," he said to her forlornly. She was a volatile woman who had never liked Jobs or appreciated her husband's infatuation with him. So when she heard what had happened, she jumped into her car and sped over to Jobs's office. Informed that he had gone to the Good Earth restaurant, she marched over there and confronted him in the parking lot as he was coming out with loyalists on his McIntosh team. "Steve, can I talk to you?" she said. His jaw dropped.
"Do you have any idea what a privilege it has been even to know someone as fine as John Scully?" she demanded.
He averted his gaze.
"Can't you look me in the eyes when I'm talking to you?" she asked.
But when Jobs did so, giving her his practiced, unblinking stare, she recoiled.
"Never mind. Don't look at me," she said. "When I look into most people's eyes, I see a soul. When I look into your eyes, I see a bottomless pit, an empty hole, a dead zone."
Then she walked away. Saturday, May 25th. Mike Murray drove to Jobs' house in Woodside to offer some advice. He should consider accepting the role of being a new product visionary, starting Apple Labs, and getting away from headquarters. Jobs seemed willing to consider it. But first he would have to restore peace with Scully. So he picked up the telephone and surprised Scully with an olive branch. Could they meet the following afternoon, Jobs asked, and take a walk together in the hills above Stanford University? They had walked there in the past, in happier times, and maybe on such a walk they could work things out. Jobs did not know that Scully had told Eisenstadt he wanted to quit, but by then it didn't matter. Overnight he had changed his mind and decided to stay. Despite the blow-up the day before, he was still eager for Jobs to like him. So he agreed to meet the next afternoon. If Jobs was prepping for conciliation, it didn't show in the choice of movie he wanted to see with Murray that night. He picked Patton, the epic of the Never Surrender General. But he had lent his copy of the tape to his father, who had once ferried troops for the general,
so he drove to his childhood home with Murray to retrieve it. His parents weren't there, and he didn't have a key. They walked around to the back, checked for unlocked doors or windows, and finally gave up. The video store didn't have a copy of Patton in stock, so in the end, he had to settle for watching the 1983 film adaptation of Harold Pinter's Betrayal. Sunday, May 26th. As planned, Jobs and Scully met in back of the Stanford campus on Sunday afternoon and walked for several hours amid the rolling hills and horse pastures. Jobs reiterated his plea that he should have an operational role at Apple. This time Scully stood firm. "It won't work," he kept saying. Scully urged him to take the role of being a product visionary with a lab of his own, but Jobs rejected this as making him into a mere figurehead. Defying all connection to reality, he countered with the proposal that Scully give up control of the entire company to him. "Why don't you become chairman and I'll become president and chief executive officer?" he suggested. Scully was struck by how earnest he seemed. "Steve, that doesn't make any sense," Scully replied. Jobs then proposed that they split the duties of running the company, with him handling the product side and Scully handling marketing and business. But the board had not only emboldened Scully, it had ordered him to bring Jobs to heel. "One person has got to run the company," he replied. "I've got the support, and you don't." On his way home, Jobs stopped at Mike Markula's house. He wasn't there, so Jobs left a message asking him to come to dinner the following evening. He would also invite the core of loyalists from his Macintosh team. He hoped that they could persuade Markula of the folly of siding with Scully. Monday, May 27th. Memorial Day was sunny and warm. The Macintosh team loyalists, Debbie Coleman, Mike Murray, Susan Barnes, and Bob Belleville, got to Jobs' Woodside home an hour before the scheduled dinner so they could plot strategy. Sitting on the patio as the sun set, Coleman told Jobs that he should accept Scully's offer to be a product visionary and help start up Apple Labs. Of all the inner circle, Coleman was the most willing to be realistic. In the new organization plan, Scully had tapped her to run the manufacturing division because he knew that her loyalty was to Apple and not just to Jobs. Some of the others were more hawkish. They wanted to urge Markula to support a reorganization plan that put Jobs in charge. When Markula showed up, he agreed to listen with one proviso. Jobs had to keep quiet. "I seriously wanted to hear the thoughts of the Macintosh team, not watch Jobs enlist them in a rebellion," he recalled. As it turned cooler, they went inside the sparsely furnished mansion and sat by a fireplace. Instead of letting it turn into a gripe session, Markula made them focus on very specific management issues, such as what had caused the problem in producing the file server software and why the Macintosh distribution system had not responded well to the change in demand. When they were finished, Markula bluntly declined to back Jobs. "I said I wouldn't support his plan, and that was the end of that," Markula recalled. Scully was the boss. They were mad and emotional and putting together a revolt, but that's not how you do things. Tuesday, May 28th. His ire stoked by hearing from Markula that Jobs had spent the previous evening trying to subvert him, Scully walked over to Jobs' office on Tuesday morning. He had talked to the board, he said, and he had its support. He wanted Jobs out. Then he drove to Markula's house, where he gave a presentation of his reorganization plans. Markula asked detailed questions, and at the end he gave Scully his blessing. When he got back to his office, Scully called the other members of the board just to make sure he still had their backing. He did. At that point, he called Jobs to make sure he understood. The board had given final approval of his reorganization plan, which would proceed that week. Gasset would take over control of Jobs' beloved Macintosh, as well as other products, and there was no other division for Jobs to run. Scully was still somewhat conciliatory. He told Jobs that he could stay on with the title of board chairman and be a product visionary with no operational duties. But by this point, even the idea of starting a skunk works such as Apple Labs was no longer on the table. It finally sank in. Jobs realized there was no appeal, no way to warp the reality. He broke down in tears and started making phone calls to Bill Campbell, Jay Elliott, Mike Murray, and others. Murray's wife Joyce was on an overseas call when Jobs phoned, and the operator broke in saying it was an emergency. "It had better be important," she told the operator. "It is," she heard Jobs say. When her husband got on the phone, Jobs was crying. "It's over," he said. Then he hung up. Murray was worried that Jobs was so despondent he might do something rash, so he called back. There was no answer, so he drove to Woodside. No one came to the door when he knocked, so he went around back and climbed up some exterior steps and looked in the bedroom. Jobs was lying there on a mattress in his unfurnished room. He let Murray in, and they talked until almost dawn. Wednesday, May 29th. Jobs finally got hold of a tape of Patton, which he watched Wednesday evening, but Murray prevented him from getting stoked up for another battle. Instead, he urged Jobs to come in on Friday for Scully's announcement of the reorganization plan. There was no option left other than to play the good soldier rather than the renegade commander. Like a rolling stone. Jobs slipped quietly into the back row of the auditorium to listen to Scully explain to the troops the new order of battle. There were a lot of sideways glances, but few people acknowledged him, and none came over to provide public displays of affection. He stared without blinking at Scully, who would remember Steve's look of contempt years later. "It's unyielding," Scully recalled, "like an X-ray boring inside your bones, down to where you're soft and destructibly mortal." For a moment, standing on stage while pretending not to notice Jobs, Scully thought back to a friendly trip they had taken a year earlier to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to visit Jobs's hero, Edwin Land. He had been dethroned from the company he created, Polaroid, and Jobs had said to Scully in disgust, "All he did was blow a lousy few million, and they took his company away from him." Now, Scully reflected, he was taking Jobs' company away from him. As Scully went over the organizational chart, he introduced Gasset as the new head of a combined Macintosh and Apple II product group. On the chart was a small box labeled Chairman with no lines connecting to it, not to Scully or to anyone else. Scully briefly noted that in that role, Jobs would play the part of global visionary, but he didn't acknowledge Jobs' presence. There was a smattering of awkward applause. Jobs stayed home for the next few days, blinds drawn, his answering machine on, seeing only his girlfriend, Tina Redsea. For hours on end, he sat there playing his Bob Dylan tapes, especially The Times They Are a-Changin'. He had recited the second verse the day he unveiled the Macintosh to the Apple shareholders 16 months earlier. That verse ended nicely, "For the loser now will be later to win." A rescue squad from his former Macintosh posse arrived to dispel the gloom on Sunday night, led by Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson. Jobs took a while to answer their knock, and then he led them to a room next to the kitchen that was one of the few places with any furniture. With Redsea's help, he served some vegetarian food he had ordered. "So what really happened?" Hertzfeld asked. "Is it really as bad as it looks?"
"No, it's worse," Jobs grimaced. "It's much worse than you can imagine."
He blamed Scully for betraying him and said that Apple would not be able to manage without him. His chairman's role, he complained, was completely ceremonial. He was being ejected from his Bandley 3 office to a small and almost empty building he nicknamed Siberia. Hertzfeldt turned the topic to happier days, and they began to reminisce about the past. Earlier that week, Dylan had released a new album, Empire Burlesque, and Hertzfeldt brought a copy that they played on Jobs' high-tech turntable. The most notable track, When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky, with its apocalyptic message, seemed appropriate for the evening, but Jobs didn't like it. It sounded almost disco, and he gloomily argued that Dylan had been going downhill since Blood on the Tracks. So Hertzfeldt moved the needle to the last song on the album, Dark Eyes, which was a simple acoustic number featuring Dylan alone on guitar and harmonica. It was slow and mournful, and Hertzfeldt hoped would remind Jobs of the earlier Dylan tracks he so loved. But Jobs didn't like that song either and had no desire to hear the rest of the album. Jobs's overwrought reaction was understandable. Scully had once been a father figure to him. So had Mike Markkula. So had Arthur Rock. That week, all three had abandoned him. It gets back to the deep feeling of being rejected at an early age, his friend and lawyer George Riley later said. It's a deep part of his own mythology, and it defines to himself who he is. Jobs recalled years later, "I felt like I'd been punched, the air knocked out of me, and I couldn't breathe." Losing the support of Arthur Rock was especially painful. "Arthur had been like a father to me," Jobs said. "He took me under wing." Rock had taught him about opera, and he and his wife, Tony, had been his hosts in San Francisco and Aspen. "I remember driving into San Francisco one time, and I said to him, 'God, that Bank of America building is ugly.' And he said, 'No, it's the best.' And he proceeded to lecture me, and he was right, of course." Years later, Jobs' eyes welled with tears as he recounted the story. "He chose Scully over me. That really threw me for a loop. I never thought he would abandon me." Making matters worse was that his beloved company was now in the hands of a man he considered a bozo. "The board felt that I couldn't run a company, and that was their decision to make," he said. "But they made one mistake. They should have separated the decision of what to do with me and what to do with Scully. They should have fired Scully, even if they didn't think I was ready to run Apple." Even as his personal gloom slowly lifted, his anger at Scully, his feeling of betrayal deepened. The situation worsened when Scully told a group of analysts that he considered Jobs irrelevant to the company despite his title as chairman. "From an operations standpoint, there is no role either today or in the future for Steve Jobs," he said. "I don't know what he'll do." The blunt comment shocked the group, and a gasp went through the auditorium. Perhaps getting away to Europe would help, Jobs thought. So in June, he went to Paris, where he spoke at an Apple event and went to a dinner honoring Vice President George H.W. Bush. From there, he went to Italy, where he drove the hills of Tuscany with Redzi and bought a bike so he could spend time riding by himself. In Florence, he soaked in the architecture of the city and the texture of the building materials. Particularly memorable were the paving stones, which came from Il Cassone quarry near the Tuscan town of Firenzuola. They were a calming bluish gray. 20 years later, he would decide that the floors of most major Apple stores would be made of this sandstone. The Apple II was just going on sale in Russia, so Jobs headed off to Moscow, where he met up with Al Eisenstadt. Because there was a problem getting Washington's approval for some of the required export licenses, they visited the commercial attaché at the American Embassy in Moscow, Mike Merwin. He warned them that there were strict laws against sharing technology with the Soviets. Jobs was annoyed. At the Paris trade show, Vice President Bush had encouraged him to get computers into Russia in order to foment revolution from below. Over dinner at a Georgian restaurant that specialized in shish kebab, Jobs continued his rant. How could you suggest this violates American law when it so obviously benefits our interests? He asked Merwin. By putting Macs in the hands of Russians, they could print all their newspapers. Jobs also showed his feisty side in Moscow by insisting on talking about Trotsky, the charismatic revolutionary who fell out of favor and was ordered assassinated by Stalin. At one point, the KGB agent assigned to him suggested he tone down his fervor. You don't want to talk about Trotsky, he said. Our historians have studied the situation, and we don't believe he's a great man anymore. That didn't help. When they got to the State University in Moscow to speak to computer students, Jobs began his speech by praising Trotsky. He was a revolutionary Jobs could identify with. Jobs and Eisenstadt attended the July 4th party at the American Embassy, and in his thank you letter to Ambassador Arthur Hartman, Eisenstadt noted that Jobs planned to pursue Apple's ventures in Russia more vigorously in the coming year. We are tentatively planning on returning to Moscow in September. For a moment, it looked as if Scully's hope that Jobs would turn into a global visionary for the company might come to pass. But it was not to be. Something much different was in store for September.